On the Record on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Great minds think unalike. Different skill sets, diverse opinions, it all adds up to the new equation.
Now, Clonus in County Monaghan is a small enough town in relative terms, a population of some 1,680 people. A century ago this week, however, its name was appearing all over the international press, and it was even being mentioned in the House of Commons over something called the Clonus Affray. Now, these were the days of the confusing new Irish border. The island was only recently partitioned at that time. A firefight in a train station left several people dead and led to severe rioting elsewhere. So how did it come about that policemen journeying from Belfast to Enniskillen ended up in a bloodbath in a Monaghan train station? Well, Donal Fallon will probably sound like he's out reporting from the scene this week. He's not. He's on Skype just taking it handy because of a close contact nearby to him. But he's on the line with us anyway. Donal, fair to say that the border in 2022, right now it's only defined by changing road signs and markings. And we all know how much effort has gone into the last couple of years to make sure that's still the case. Back in 1922, the border was still pretty ambiguous as well.
Yeah, and you know, these days you can pass through the border on a journey across Ulster only aware you've done so because of the text on your mobile phone, you know, that text that you get from your operator. And the disappearance of bilingual signage is another thing. But in the early months of 1922 and kind of the immediate aftermath of the treaty, things were also a little bit confusing on the border. And a century ago this week, on the 11th of February 1922, this incredible incident occurs, and we'll go through it in detail because it's a kind of confusing one. When armed members of the Ulster Special Constabulary, or the Specials, would arrive in this train station in Clonus, travelling from Belfast to Enniskillen, and listeners might be wondering, well, what were they doing in Clonus in the first place? We'll get into that. But their presence on the wrong side of the border, so to speak, you know, nobody really understood what was going on, but it would spark this incredibly violent and confusing incident.
And one of the things which makes this maybe slightly difficult to get to the bottom of is that people's understanding of what happened sort of depends on the media that they consumed, or basically sort of what side of a sectarian divide they might be on, because the actual event itself was so open to different interpretation and to different people's imaginations as well.
Absolutely. A firefight in a train station between the IRA and the Specials. I mean, the day is a real lesson in how different newspapers tell different stories of the one event. So in the confusion, some people reported on this as an incursion into the south, you know, by the Specials, that we were being invaded. What were these policemen, heavily armed policemen at that, doing in a Monaghan town, you know, the Southern Press asked. In the north, kind of unionist inclined newspapers presented this as a massacre, you know, a kind of savage act of violence that had left policemen dead and others hospitalised. And the idea that these men had somehow been lured to their deaths, you know, that was a powerful and provocative one. And this event would trigger kind of real sustained violence in Belfast in its aftermath. But what also makes this kind of confusing is that we've very little firsthand testimony. And the firsthand recollection we do have, it comes from the Bureau of Military History. These are, you know, recollections taken decades later and sometimes unreliable. So it's an entirely, that there was a firefight in a train station in Monaghan is just about all we agree on. Beyond that, it's an incredibly murky affair.
So that point then about the Bureau of Military History, so this was an agency which was set up to take first-hand accounts, but because it was set up so far afterwards that everyone's memories are maybe a little bit hazy or subject to reinterpretation based on what followed.
Oh, absolutely. And the same event from five different protagonists. There's five different stories, as there always is.
Fair enough. It's like Ulysses of its own day, because we have to get one Ulysses mentioned in. It's the law for this lot. Things were already kind of insanely tense in Monaghan at the time anyway. I mean, right down to the local Gaelic football team being arrested a few weeks previously.
Yeah, Monaghan, in a lot of ways, kind of embodies the situation on the border. It's a fluid, moving situation. About a quarter of the population of the county, and I didn't notice, but about a quarter of the population of Monaghan at the time of partition is Protestant. So, you know, it's not homogenous. And really no county on either side of the border is totally homogenous one way or the other. And it's a place that's, you know, its place on the border is leading to a lot of friction. There are just things happening in Monaghan in the early weeks of 1922 that are not helpful. You know, on the 14th of January, the Monaghan Gaelic football team are basically arrested as they're making their way to an Ulster Championship game in Derry. And look, this being Ireland in 1922, some of those Gaelic footballers were IRA volunteers, others weren't. But the idea of a county Gaelic football team being arrested, it is front page news. It's quite embarrassing, and it says a lot about the state of the country. Then there's a brazen attempt to have the, you know, we might call them the footballing revolutionaries released. So the IRA launched a series of incursions into Northern Ireland, basically into Tyrone and Enniskillen. And to our ears, I mean, to modern ears listening to this, it kind of sounds like the Tet Offensive in Vietnam. Like, they're literally pouring over the border. They're cutting communications, cutting telephone wires, burning specific targets, and get this, taking dozens of hostages and bringing them back across the border with them, which is just incredible. So B-specials, Orangemen, Unionist officials amongst the people that are kidnapped in an attempt to kind of, you know, an attempt to barter, if you will, for their own men back. So the Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, James Craig, he describes this to the British government as a deliberate and organised attack on Ulster. And how do they respond in Northern Ireland? Well, they blow up bridges, they mine roads, they trench roads. They essentially try and cut off us and them, if you will, on the border. But there's a real situation of tension that's building in the border counties, and especially in Monaghan.
The idea of some IRA people going across the border that they object to the existence of and reject the legitimacy of to bring people back to their own side, where apparently they would be beyond the reach of the North, and then this being described as an attack on Ulster, despite the attack coming from within the province of Ulster. I don't mean to be glib, but like, it's a very Irish story, really, isn't it? Who exactly was doing this stuff, invading the border and actually taking the hostages?
You see, what makes this all particularly wild is that when you hear of this stuff, you picture in your head, when we talk about the IRA in early 1922, we're presumably talking about the anti-treaty Republicans.
Yeah.
But in the border counties, things are really strange, and there's all kinds of strange alliances forming. So Robert Lynch, the historian, is looking at this in detail. He writes about Michael Collins and his confused early attempts to impede the establishment of Northern Ireland. Because strange as this sounds, Collins and other kind of pro-treaty military men are actually flirting with the IRA in the border counties, you know, and they're trying to convince them, and maybe they're trying to convince themselves on one level, that there could be some kind of campaign there. In other words, you know, we need to do this treaty, we need to make peace in Dublin. But it seems kind of bizarre, doesn't it, to preach politics in Dublin and then kind of whisper war into the ears of people in Monaghan or Donegal and Cavan.
You can sort of, you can understand the sort of the conflicting ambitions, though, that this idea that you need to sort of constitutionally play ball, but also that when it comes to the real politique of stuff on the ground, you'd quite like for the North just disappear as an entity.
Absolutely. So you're moving weapons into these border counties, and you're kind of convincing those young men on the border that there will be some kind of offensive in the North. So when people are being kidnapped and brought into the South, you know, the question is, who's doing this? And in the House of Commons, one MP suggests these various men have been kidnapped by the Free State. And that mightn't be entirely wrong on one level, you know. And the entire situation is a mess in which nobody, Collins, Churchill, Craig, nobody seems to entirely trust one another. There's just a lot of realpolitik, as you put it, going on around the fringes.
So this is the backdrop then against which we have the Clonus affray and a trainload of specials who arrive into Clonus on what is otherwise a fairly quiet Saturday evening. The very fact that these specials show up in Clonus, does that immediately kind of set people's radars twitching? Are people immediately aware that something is off?
I mean, weeks after the arrest of the county football team, the kidnapping of loyalists is still making headlines. It's still being talked about in the House of Commons. It just seems perplexing that a train of specials would even consider it wise to alight in Clonus. But that's what they do on the 11th of February. And I think, you know, when people are looking for a reason that they did this, macho bravado might be a factor in it. You know, just the fact that we can do it and we're going to do it. A way of saying, you know, we're not afraid. And for whatever reason, 5:15 p.m. on a Saturday, Sergeant William Doherty and his party of specials arrive into Clonus train station, and they get off the train. And initially, it sounds pretty dull. I mean, Lynch, the historian, he writes about, on arrival, Sergeant Doherty gathered the 6-man armed party on the platform. The rest made their way to the buffet. You know, they went for lunch. One or two others strolled about the station, mingling with civilians and kicking their heels until the train arrived. All totally normal stuff. Bored people standing on a train platform, as is probably happening across the island now. But when word reaches the local IRA that these specials, armed specials, are on the platform in the train station, the scene is set. And the kind of panic descends on the local IRA who rush to the train station.
So this is a point maybe this worth underlining for people who get the geography of all of this, that there wasn't a direct line from Belfast to Enniskillen, so you would have ended up having to transfer at Clonus to get another one. And that is what brought them then south of the border, ostensibly because they were just taking a journey from A to B. But of course, word gets out that there might be something else at play. And it's not long then before the first shot rings out and there's a young IRA man killed instantly. But then it escalates very, very quickly and basically becomes what sounds like a bloodbath.
The facts of this are really confusing, but we know this much. Matt Fitzpatrick, local IRA leader, and a kind of small party arrive at the station. Matt has a revolver in hand. He approaches the train. And one of his right-hand men remembers that when we got on the platform, we turned towards the engine as the train was due to start. We then turned back towards the rear of the train. Commandant Fitzpatrick was leading the men down the platform. I was behind him. On reaching the first compartment where the specials were, our commandant shouted, "Hands up, surrender." There was a shot from the compartment and Fitzpatrick dropped dead in front of me. So total carnage then opens up. One IRA man in the station opens up on the train with a Thompson submachine. I mean, the Tommy gun. This gun is a serious piece of equipment, remembered in human history as the Chicago typewriter or the gun of Al Capone. Like, one of these things opens up in the train station. And as that man remembered, I continued firing until all movement in these carriages had ceased, which proved to me that all the occupants were either killed or severely wounded. I mean, can you just imagine the sound of a Tommy gun opening up in a train station? Absolutely chaotic stuff.
That is brutal stuff. And sorry, I kind of smirked when you mentioned the Chicago typewriter, because that wasn't a nickname that I was aware of. But yeah, you don't want to smirk then when you hear about the way in which it's deployed. But
that's popular culture, and it does recall things like the Valentine's Day Massacre. It's a very particular gun, isn't it? With a very unique place
in
popular history. And just to imagine it opening up at a train station is extraordinary.
Yeah, and then because the shooting only finishes when there is no movement at all in the carriages, and of course this was also a civilian train with many civilians around, then a lot of people who are lost in the firefight are people who are civilians just going about their lives, and those who survive talk of it being a fairly brutal affair.
There's no civilian fatalities, but there are some injuries. I mean, in the mix of people that are on the train, you've got a former nationalist MP. He's just going about his business. I mean, these are just ordinary people living an ordinary day, as most people are on the island of Ireland in 1922. Another man talks about a bullet going through his hat. You know, he's lucky to survive. And then one guy who's on the train, he's interviewed, and the way he describes it is just absolutely unbelievable. One of the bullets flashed across my face and grazed my hat. I could hear shots being discharged all over the train, mingled with the yells and screams of the men in the other carriages. And later, this train is allowed to make its way onwards with the bodies of the four specials on board. And when it arrives at its intended destination, when it pulls into Enniskillen, it just looks like something out of a nightmare. I mean, the train is totally shot up. It's described as resembling an abattoir. There's just blood everywhere. And the sight of that train really sparks fury immediately. There's a breakdown of law and order. As soon as word of this reaches kind of loyalist towns, just absolute fury on the other side of the border.
Yeah, and then this is where things go from already pretty bad to somehow even worse, because there's all the repercussions elsewhere, and they in turn are something that then leave Winston Churchill himself to be very visibly moved.
When word of what has happened on this train in Clonus gets to, I suppose, when it gets to Belfast, it triggers just prolonged sectarian violence in that city. And Lynch writes about 43 people killed there, 27 Catholics, 16 Protestants. So it's not a one-way street, you know, sectarian tit-for-tat violence, even at that time. And one of the grimmest kind of incidents of 20th century Irish history, which isn't widely known, and the centenary of it has passed largely without comment, a bomb is thrown into a schoolyard in the York Road district of the city, the Catholic area, killing two children instantly, and four others die shortly after. And this is totally shocking. It's the kind of tragedy that makes politicians of all stripes just reevaluate things, isn't it? And Winston Churchill in the House of Commons, quite visibly moved, he describes this as the worst thing that has happened in Ireland in the last 3 years. And when you think of everything that had happened in Ireland in the last 3 years, the carnage of Bloody Sunday and more, I mean, Churchill is a hard man. He's a hawk much longer than a dove when it comes to Ireland. But the tragedy of those deaths, I think it moved everyone, and it brought some much needed perspective on the need for peace. But it's extraordinary how a moment of confusion in a train station in Monaghan can kind of directly and indirectly culminate in children lying dead on the streets of Belfast.
Yeah, and you mentioned at the very start when we started out on this slot about the Bureau of Military History and how far after the fact it was before first-hand testimonies of this were ever sort of recorded, which means that it's all, to some degree, still a little bit of a mystery, as firefights generally are. But you have, you mentioned that some of the events weren't really marked. There have been some events recently to try and mark the centenary passing.
Yeah, and I think historians should always be conscious of this. I always try and remind myself of this, that what we might write out in pages, you know, or in a chapter of a book, actually happens in total seconds, you know. And what defines these moments, historians and Robert Lynch has done great work on this. We can look at something years later and try and piece it together. But the reason it's hard to piece together is things like this happen in seconds. It's just chaos. Who fired first? And there are lots of questions around this when I was thinking about it. I mean, obvious questions. why did the specials get off in Clonus? Why were they armed in a situation of such tension? Why take guns out visibly on the other side of the border? But then on the other side, why did the IRA bring a Thompson submachine gun to such a volatile situation? I mean, there's questions all around this story. And a new exhibition has just opened in the brilliant County Museum in Monaghan, trying to tell this story. There's some really moving personal artifacts from people that were there. And I think the curator, Liam Bradley, he just captured it brilliantly. He said, look, it's a simple incident, getting off at a railway in the wrong place at the wrong time. That's how much of a tinderbox the country was sitting on at the time. To be in the wrong place in the wrong time could mean your life. And it's just, yeah, we talk about the decade of centenaries as winding down now after the signing of the treaty. But these little bizarre incidents were still happening across the island of Ireland in the weeks and months that followed.
It is very well captured in that quote by Liam Bradley, just this idea that all you need is one person to give you the wrong glance, or somebody to interpret something maybe malign as something all the more ulterior, and then things just kick off in an incredible way. It is a remarkable story, and it's one that is worth hearing about given we marked the centenary of that this week. Donald Fallon, as ever, thank you for that. Donald Fallon, who is the author of From Henrietta Street, From Tenement to Suburbia, which is a catalogue of Dublin through the 20th century, and he's also the presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast on Dublin history, which you'll find anywhere you get your audio online.